This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The State of the Union in an election year. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The president spoke last night in the aftermath of the bungled response to Katrina, the failure to reform Social Security, and the mess in Iraq. By comparison to his past State of the Union addresses, this one contained modest proposals. His statement that America is addicted to oil got a lot of the headlines, but there was little detail about getting off the petroleum economy. After the worst year of his presidency, he and other Republicans are worried about holding on to the Congress in this year's elections. On To the Point, we'll get assessments from the left and the right, reaction from Europe, and some historical perspective. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Last night's State of the Union address is being described as modest and cautious, designed with an eye to holding the Congress in this year's elections. On To the Point, what are its strengths and its weaknesses? We'll get a variety of opinions. First, this news update. The latest report on the federal response to Hurricane Katrina fingers a member of the president's cabinet for the first time. The Government Accountability Office, that's the investigative arm of the Congress, singles out Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. Bobby Block reports on Homeland Security for the Wall Street Journal, writes under the name Robert Block. Bobby, good to have you back with us.
Thanks, Warren.
What does this have to say about the chain of command?
That there wasn't one. That it was sorely lacking. It's like you said in your introduction, this thing is important in the fact that for the first time, it really doesn't focus on Michael Brown, and it doesn't focus on FEMA, and it doesn't look at Governor Blanco or Ray Nagin. It basically says it was the fault of the Department of Homeland Security. And actually, it's some of the language, which is surprising for the GAO, which sometimes, you know, it can be as ruthless as being savaged by a dead sheep. It says quite openly that this failure to fill this leadership role underscored the immaturity and weaknesses relating to the current national response framework, which basically means the weakness and immaturity of the department itself.
The department is certainly striking back, though, and says the findings are premature and unprofessional, have obvious errors that could have been corrected in the most basic conversations with leaders of the department.
Well, I mean, you know, even a rabbit when cornered will kick back. First off, the GAO does not label the statement which was made by the Comptroller General David Walker as final findings. They are clearly labeled as preliminary observations. Secondly, it is increasingly clear, as more and more documents start to spill out of the Katrina hearings and some of the other documents, that the excuses that the Department of Homeland Security offered up originally, such as who could have ever expected this, are weak and are not supported by the facts. One of the documents that emerged last week that was actually released by the Democrats on the Senate panel investigating this was a document that was done by Homeland Security's own infrastructure department. They inherited from the Department of Energy a department which has to conduct simulations, very sophisticated computer simulations. And before the hurricane struck on Saturday, it sent out a notification to all of the top officials at DHS, as well as to some people in the White House, saying, this is bad, and you can expect that the levees will fail. They will break, and there will be massive flooding and big trouble. And it seems this report it seemed to disappear into a vacuum because it did not seem to raise the alarm bells inside of DHS nor the White House.
And the president, of course, said very publicly, nobody told us the levees were going to break. We're talking with Bobby Block of the Wall Street Journal. It seems to me that the report of David Walker goes even higher than Secretary Chertoff, because it says, first of all, that it was a decade ago that the same GAO said you've got to have somebody in charge. And then when asked who it should be, he said, well, it ought to be that's the president's decision.
Well, I mean, you have to remember, what he's referring to is what, you know, I mean, it's very funny. If you go back and you look at exactly the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew, which is what he's referring to, when we were in very similar circumstances, when the federal government was caught short, the president's father was in office, it was a very similar situation where the Washington, in the aftermath, was saying it was the fault of the governor and of the state, and the state was saying, but we told you we needed help, and you didn't say it in the right way. There was all kinds of commotion and discussions about should the military run it, and the conclusion came. And remember, then they were talking about destroying FEMA, which is once again seems to be the topic on the plate of Congress again today. GAO came out with a report and said, look, you got to reform all this, and there's got to be a point man. And Clinton came into office and revived FEMA by effectively putting a point man in charge. It put James Lee Witt in charge, and James Lee Witt had power not only by the legislation that existed in that case was the Stafford Act, and they had a plan which wasn't called the National Response Plan then. That's what it's called now. Then it was called the Federal Response Plan. But the strength was, A, James Lee Witt's vision and his ability to reform the department, but B, even more importantly, he had a direct phone line to the president. And it's not clear that Secretary Chertoff and certainly Michael Brown had that direct link to the president.
Talking with Bobby Block, once again, no Homeland Security correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. You say this is only a preliminary finding. How much more is to be done?
Well, I think it's all coming to a head. I think that in the next weeks what we're going to see, I know that the White House's own investigation, which is being headed by Fran Townsend, who's the president's Homeland Security advisor, her report on what went wrong is supposed to come out. She's had one briefing with journalists in which she said it represented a failure of the federal government. That's due to come out. Also due to come out is these hearings, both in the House and in the Senate, are winding up. They will be coming out with reports, and Collins and Lieberman, who are the joint heads of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs in the Senate, they are drafting legislation as we speak.
All right.
And just lastly, at the same time this is going on, Chertoff is basically, quote, retooling FEMA, which seems to be breaking it up.
Bobby Block with the Wall Street Journal, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Good to be back.
On Reporter's Notebook later, caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad and the press freedom in Europe. In a moment, the State of the Union in an election year on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. White House speechwriters reportedly worked on 30 drafts before completing last night's State of the Union address. Even Republicans agree last year was the worst of the Bush presidency, with the bungled response to Katrina, the failure of Social Security reform, and what many see as a mess in Iraq. Did last night's speech provide the recipe to turn things around before the November elections? Byron York is author of the vast left-wing conspiracy. He's White House correspondent for the conservative National Review. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be here.
Did he do it? Did he score?
Well, I think it was a pretty good speech, but a State of the Union speech certainly doesn't turn things around for a president. I think much more effective in turning things around would be, political success in Iraq, getting the upper hand over the insurgency, and that sort of thing. So, but on the other hand, I think Bush made some very, very strong statements. I think his statements on American leadership in international affairs were good and were resolute, and I think his statements on alternative energy sources were really pretty newsworthy.
Well, I didn't say that this speech would turn things around, but rather asked the question, did it provide the recipe for turning things around? Certainly that's what Republicans are looking for, aren't they?
Well, it certainly could, but in that sense, I mean, it hasn't differed from earlier ones. I mean, certainly in January or February 2005, we wanted to have success and fewer American deaths in Iraq in that year. But I do think that the mixture of you know, continued resoluteness in foreign affairs, some sort of lobbying or ethics reform on Capitol Hill, which the president unsurprisingly came out for, and if he actually pursued something like the alternative fuel proposal, I think that is a good political mix for the president.
So it was good language in the case of alternative fuel, but we don't know yet to what extent it is going to be pursued.
Well, it may be an unreachable goal, but I do remember, you know, it was a couple of years ago the president, in another State of the Union address, committed the country to pursuing hydrogen energy, which is, you know, it's possible, but it's way off. And what he did in this speech, I think, was mention some technologies that are closer and that would benefit by immediate spending programs and would help reduce, not end, but reduce the nation's dependence on Middle Eastern oil. So his goal of replacing more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025 is probably not reachable. On the other hand, progress is good.
On the other hand, 75% of Middle East oil is only 75% of 10% of total importation of oil, as I understand it.
Well, but the president did make a clear link between oil and the instability of the Middle East. And I'll tell you something. I've spoken to White House officials, and they believe that in the 2004 campaign, Democrats did get some traction with the charge that we needed to become more energy independent, and that it was a terrible thing in light of September 11th and all the other events, that we'd be so heavily dependent on Saudi Arabia for a large part of our oil. So I think the president wanted to get out ahead of that issue because they realized that Democrats had scored points with it.
Barbara New York, White House correspondent, National Review. David Corn is Washington editor for the liberal magazine The Nation. He's also author of The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. David Corn, always good to have you with us.
Good to be with you again, Warren.
Did you see more politics of deception last night?
Well, same old, same old. I mean, I think, you know, I don't disagree with what Byron says about the energy issues. I mean, that's a matter that will be proven whether, you know, the plans he puts forward, the legislation that comes through, actually has any real significant impact, whether they come up with the funding for this. They talked about switchgrass. I mean, is that one particular form of biomass that's controlled by one particular energy or agricultural company? I don't know. I mean,
let me just stop you on it. One moment on that. What is switchgrass?
You tell me.
You don't know. Byron York, do you know what switchgrass
is? It was a Bill Clinton moment, it seemed to me.
But quickly, Byron York, just on this point, do you know what switchgrass is?
I was laughing because you were sticking David with that question. No, I don't.
Okay. Back to you, David Corn. Go ahead. So we got switchgrass, whatever it is.
Whatever it is. But he sure sounds smart talking about it, didn't he? But someone who writes to me, my blog from North Dakota, Bob says, it's a very unremarkable native grass that produces biomass, not much different than wheat straw, corn stalks, or lawn clippings. You can see that at davidcorn.com from a fellow who has a PhD in agronomy. But I thought that, you know, the speech was really about Iraq. That's what it was about. And he asked about the politics of deception. This is what the president said. He said, we have to fight around the world for freedom and democracy, and we have to help those poor people. We can't forget the people in Burma, in Syria, in Iran. He didn't mention China, for instance, but he mentioned a few countries. And then he said, and that's why we're fighting in Iraq. And if we don't fight in Iraq, people like Al-Qaeda, like Bin Laden and Zakari will take over Iraq and use it as a strategic haven to attack the United States from. That is just complete analytical baloney. I think that's a technical term. There is nobody out there who believes that Zakari is anywhere near to taking over Iraq. There's already a Shiite theocracy backed by Iran that's in charge of Iraq, and they happen to have several militias of their own. But Bush was telling the American public, and this is, yeah, I mean, this, I think I get a little angry about this, so I apologize, but he was telling the American public that we're fighting in Iraq to keep Zakari from taking over. It's simply not true.
Okay, back to Byron New York. What about that? Is that a minor league criticism, or is that important?
Well, look, I think our enemy in Iraq at the moment is widely known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, led by Zarqawi. And clearly, I mean, what we're hoping for in the progressively more inclusive governments that are being formed in Iraq is to unify people to stop this terrorist force. But listen, if Zarqawi is successful in driving the United States and the coalition out, there is no telling at exactly how influential he will be and how much you'll be able to use Iraq as a base for other operations.
So, David Corn, is it possible then that he could, in fact, be the kind of threat the president said he was?
That is not. The president himself, in previous speeches, has identified the foreign jihadists led by Zarqawi as the smallest portion of the forces we're fighting. By far, it's more a native-based insurgency. And yes, Zarqawi and al-Qaeda in Iraq are worrisome issues. But to tell the public that if we pull out, he will take over, that's exactly what the president said. Now, you know, is it a theoretical possibility? Yeah, it's theoretical that UFO aliens will come over and take over the Republican Party tomorrow. But in the real world, it's not the real reason why we may have to be in Iraq. And that, I think, is comic book analysis that is really trying to play on the worst fears of Americans and not addressing the true challenges and the nature of the conflict there.
So, Byron York, what about that? Is he exaggerating then? And is it, as David Corn describes it, a kind of comic book approach?
Well, this is who we're fighting in Iraq. The Americans who are dying from improvised explosive devices and small arms fire attacks in Iraq are dying from this this insurgency that is being led by Zarqawi. At the moment, he is the enemy in Iraq, and we know that he has made common cause with Osama bin Laden wherever he is and however strong he is. And so I think to characterize them as the enemy is entirely okay. Accurate.
All right. Let me introduce another perspective into this. Carol Doherty is Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Thank you very much for joining us.
Nice to be there.
You look at the polls. I know you haven't done any polls since the State of the Union address. Pretty hard to do that quickly. But let me ask you this. The conversation that we're hearing, no doubt, sparked by the president's speech, has so far talked about resoluteness in Iraq, about what David Corn describes as a misdescription of the real threat in Iraq. We've heard about the threat of Middle East oil and about alternative energy. If those are the issues, the principal issues that the president raised, or among them, how important are they to the American people? How do they play politically in this election year?
Well, I think Iraq is as divisive as ever and as divisive among the public as it was in the Congress last night. I mean, where you saw a clear division every time Bush mentioned something about Iraq, Democrats sat on their hands and Republicans cheered widely. I think you get that same kind of partisan gap. That's not going to change. That hasn't changed in quite a while. In terms of where the president went domestically, one of the interesting things in our recent polling is that energy is becoming a much more important priority for the American public. On the details, we don't know how they're going to play, but it is becoming, since the run-up in gas prices that followed Katrina, it is, and energy independence is becoming a more important priority. So on those grounds, I think the president was addressing some of the needs of the American people.
Is he perceived, or will he be perceived as a result of this, as Byron York put it, as getting ahead on this issue?
I think making a strong statement on it, I think, is probably important. I mean, where I thought he probably came up a little bit short was on health care. We were told he would say a lot more about that, and of course that's also a growing concern, affordability of health care, one of the top national economic problems in our most recent poll. But there really wasn't a whole lot there on health care. We were expecting, according to the news reports before the speech, a little bit more on that subject.
Carol Doherty with the Pew Research Center. Back to Byron York. What about that? Did he shortchange his own constituency with regard to health care?
Well, there was less on health care than I thought there would be. There was less detailed discussion about health care than I thought there would be. One more small note on oil and energy independence. I think it was particularly important for Bush to say this because most of his statements about energy had in the past been directed toward how do we get more oil or how do we refine more of it. So for him actually to highlight and showcase an alternative fuels program was probably pretty smart on his part and actually important.
This is To the Point from PRI. David Korn, back to you at The Nation magazine. Nothing about Anwar, the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, as Byron York suggests. Maybe the president is turning around on this.
Well, there were a lot of things that weren't mentioned last night. There was nothing about Anwar, as you mentioned. There was nothing about global warming. We've had a lot of news lately that's been very bad on the global warming front. He didn't take that. He didn't talk about college education. He talked only about high school education. He didn't talk about wage levels in America. He didn't talk about freedom and democracy in a place like China. A lot was left out. Now, presidents who do these speeches are often accused of putting in laundry lists of policy proposals and so on. But he got, to make a pun, he got down into the weeds with switchgrass, but then he couldn't address global warming. So, I thought that was rather bizarre on his part. The domestic side really boiled down to a few policies that he wants to try to push in Congress that had no real theme to it.
Terrell Daugherty, back to you with the Pew Research Center. What about global warming? Is that an issue that is going to be important, do you think, or might potentially be important in this election year?
Probably not so much this election year, but again, this is another issue. We were surprised when we did a major priorities list, as we always do in January. Energy was up, as we expected, with the rise in gas price, but environment, protecting the environment, was up as well. So people don't necessarily see you have to take one without the other. I think people are becoming more concerned about the environment, certainly a lot more media coverage of global warming and the environment generally in the past year or so.
So, Byron York, back to you, back to this question of whether this was a recipe for success in the November elections. Do you think that the president, by this address, is going to be able to shape the agenda his way? And if so, why do you think that?
Well, not just by himself, but it was a recipe for success in a way that we really haven't discussed, which is his description of American involvement in the war, and very specifically the war in Iraq, and also the war on terrorism, as it involves things like what Bush calls the terrorist surveillance program, what other people call domestic spying. I think Bush, in the speech, very clearly set out a choice between you can stay involved in the world, you can lead, which will take you to ultimately to more safety and stability, or you can retreat from the world and make the world a more dangerous place. Now, I'm going to lead, and these Democrats over here, well, we'll see what happens. And I think you have to weigh that with what Karl Rove said a couple of weeks ago in a speech to the RNC here in Washington, in which he said Democrats have a pre-September 11th view of the world, Republicans have a post-September 11th view of the world. Doesn't make them unpatriotic, but it makes them deeply wrong. And I think that's one of the themes you're going to see all year.
David Korn, this appears to be exactly what Byron York says it is, one of the major themes for this year. What about it? How are the Democrats going to respond to that?
Well, Bush said last night again and again, I don't want to be an isolationist. We shouldn't be isolationists. As if anybody who has doubts, skepticism about Iraq is an isolationist. It's clear to me that they came up with some focus group data or polling data that said to them, call them isolationists and defeatists and retreatists, and that will work rather well politically. You can't call people like Bill Oldham, the former director of the National Security Agency, an isolationist for saying we should disengage from Iraq. And it is Rovian politics to come up with these terms to make the Democrats, anyone who raises questions, not even Democrats, look to be wimps and scaredy cats, and as if they don't want to engage in the world because they think he made a mistake in Iraq and he's not doing the job right now. And that's, Bush said he wanted to raise the tone of the debate at the very beginning. This is not raising the tone of the debate.
All right, that's all the time we've got. We'll be trying to separate the rhetoric from the reality as this campaign year goes on. David Korn, Byron York, Carol Daugherty, thanks all of you very much for being with us. On Reporter's Notebook, cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and press freedom in Europe. In a moment, more with this conversation about the State of the Union on To the Point from PRI.
Mm-hmm.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Roman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the President's State of the Union address, from switchgrass to health care to alternative energy to the war in Iraq. It touched on a lot of subjects, many more than just those. One of those who watched carefully the speech last night and who has listened carefully to our conversation this morning is Mary Dashevsky, chief editorial writer of the Independent newspaper in London. She's former diplomatic editor, former Washington bureau chief for the Independent newspaper in London. Once again, Mary Dashevsky, it's always good to have you with us.
Very good to be there.
One of the things the president said last night was the only alternative to American leadership is a dramatically more dangerous and anxious world. How did that one go down with you, and how did the speech in general go down, do you think, in Europe?
Well, I think it's interesting that I noticed that as being something that Europeans would probably regard very much as sort of scare tactics and a little unnecessary. But in fact, it wasn't the main thing that was noticed, whether in Britain or I think in continental Europe. What we fastened onto was the attention that was paid to the environment and specifically to oil and the need for renewable sources of energy and to reduce dependence on the Middle East. And I think that was an extremely interesting digression and an unexpected departure for the State of the Union address.
The Europe is more dependent than on the Middle East for oil than the United States, is it not?
It's probably about the same, but we are in the process, for better or worse, switching some of our dependency to Russia with the development of new pipelines, and obviously with other questions about that still open, we remain dependent.
So how important then is it for Europe if the United States begins not just talking this way, but actually has a program to develop alternative sources of energy?
Well, I think it's hugely welcome because it suggests that the United States, which is regarded in Europe as an extremely profligate user of energy, is starting to pay attention to this and thinking that it's undesirable to have such a gigantic appetite and that it should not only diversify but be more economical. So I think in Europe that would be seen as a very good development. What I think was surprising, though, was that the only link that Mr. Bush made last night was with the security situation in the Middle East. He said it was undesirable for America to be so dependent for its oil on an unstable part of the world. Well, the way Europe looks at it would say, yes, that's an entirely valid point, but there is another point, which is about climate change and global warming, and that renewable sources of energy, alternative sources of energy, economizing on energy, all that is important, not for geopolitical reasons, but for environmental reasons. And that, as I think one of your previous speakers pointed out, was entirely missing from the Bush speech.
That's right. And so far, the president hasn't really acknowledged global warming as the kind of problem that you describe and that it is seen as by others. How did you feel or what did you think about his style of presentation and his mood as he addressed the Congress? How'd that look to you?
Well, I thought it was actually extraordinarily impressive that here was this president. It had been billed in advance as a speech that would concentrate on generalities rather than specifics. There's the whole question of falling ratings, problems at home, stalemate in policymaking domestically, what looks very much like growing anarchy despite the recent elections in Iraq, the way America is bogged down there, problems with North Korea, Iran, all these things going on. And it seemed to me that the president gave an extraordinarily confident performance yesterday. I mean, he hardly missed a word, and he sounded and looked very convinced and very persuasive. Now, I mean, I think to me and to probably people in Britain and Europe, we're not necessarily convinced by what he said or by the line that he takes, but personally, I found the presentation very impressive and I think a big improvement on previous years.
Mary Jasewski, once again, the chief editorial writer of the Independent newspaper in London. Stay with us, if you will. I want to introduce our final guest for this segment of our program, Stephen Hess, who is a man who served on the White House staffs of Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon. He was an advisor to Presidents Ford and Carter. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's now distinguished professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. Takes 10 minutes to read your qualifications, Stephen Hess. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Your take. You've looked at a lot of States of the Union addresses. You've worked on them. Did this president, do you think, appear somehow improved in his delivery and style and confidence?
Well, he was certainly improved in his delivery. No question about that. Anybody can judge that. But I guess I have a right to say, having worked on three of them, that State of the Union addresses are usually, as speeches, pretty awful. If you want elegance, you go to the inaugural address. I think probably the only really elegant State of the Union address was Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms address in 1941. But what interests me more than that, because I think that's almost a given, is what's happened to this institution since in the almost 50 years, the 45 years, that I had to work at. Those speeches under Eisenhower, 59, 60, and so forth, were delivered at noon. So they weren't prime time speeches. And there wasn't an opposition speech afterwards, and they didn't have a lady in the balcony to be introduced. It was, and so the speech was of a much lower key. You didn't have Republicans plotting like mad and Democrats standing on their hands or sitting on their hands or anything like that, and the camera roving around till they could find whether Hillary Clinton was moving her eyes. In 1965, this all started when Lyndon Johnson told the networks that he was going to give his speech in prime time, and the rest followed. And the next year, Everett McKinley Dirksen, the Republican leader, said, "Hey, I want to get into that action." And he said, "Networks, give us the opposition sometime after." Then networks said, "Sure, nobody's listening anyway. And anyway, everybody only listens to three networks, and so we all have it, and so it's no disincentive to our ratings." That was a terrible thing that Dirksen did and the networks did. This is a speech that is, in a sense, in the Constitution. It revolves around the President of the United States, all the people, and suddenly we've got him up there now as a partisan leader of one party, and the other party will have its crack at it. And then, of course, along came the Lenny Skolniks, where we always have to look for somebody in the balcony. And I heard somebody the other day say they now watch the State of the Union speech the way some people watch the Super Bowl. They look for the commercials. So what it's become increasingly is a semi-campaign speech, especially in even-numbered years like we're in right now. So I'm sad about that. When I helped to write the speech, it was generally a flight plan for the next year in the federal government, largely the executive branch, which he was the head of, but also with some suggestions for the Congress. You didn't have to go through all of these gimmicks, and the gimmicks include, by the way, the media, who spend a week asking you, is this going to be a make-or-break speech for the President of the United States? And you say, well, I don't really think so. And then, of course, they have no story. And you say, well, really, the State of the Union speech rarely has any lasting effect on a president's approval rating, and this one probably won't either.
So these are the imperatives of the media age, it would appear, in which politics has certainly been transformed, although I don't know that we're going to change it very much. Stephen Hess, I want to go back to Mary Jasewski. I'm fascinated to get your comment on what we have just heard. I think Thomas Jefferson said that he didn't want to deliver a speech to the Congress, even though the Constitution said something about having a message to deliver every year, because it was too much like the message that the King delivers to the Parliament.
Well, I think the State of the Union at least has got safely beyond that in developing a genre very much of its own type. And I think it is interesting that, I mean, even since I've been following them, which is about 10 years, I think it's been noticed more and more abroad, and that it's now seen as much as a declaration of American foreign policy for consumption abroad as it is a domestic occasion. And I think maybe that's a bit of a change as well.
So then I take it it's taken very seriously by people in Europe, not just political junkies, but people who just watch to see what's happening in politics.
Absolutely. And you'd be surprised. I mean, not only how many people actually stay up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to watch it, but that it is relayed in full on several of the breakfast programs the next morning.
So, Stephen Hess, back to you. Are you surprised, A, to hear that, and B, in this context, and given all the audiences that the president has to address, we can refer back to the nature of the media again, how do you do?
Oh, I'm sort of shocked with that. I'm fascinated by that because I hate to think that the rest of the world is seeing us through the prism of this particular speech. Let me tell you a bit about what happens with this speech every year. In September, President sits down with his advisors and says, I'm going to have some grand themes. You know, no more of that laundry list stuff. The Secretary of the Cabinet sends out a memo to all the departments, and they want their wish list, and they come in. By the 10th draft, somebody says, gee, we better have something in there for the veterans. By the 12th draft, they say, well, you know, the wheat farmers are unhappy. And by the time you're finished, as last night, you started with some grand themes in the beginning and then just dribbled into smaller and smaller programs. The smaller and smaller programs this year as opposed to last year just reflected the fact that there's no money.
So, Mary Duszewski, this is how the sausage is made. Does that surprise you?
Not hugely, because I think we had some insight into this with the with the question of uranium and the what is it, the Axis of Evil, a couple of
the uranium from Niger in in Africa, that whole dispute.
Yes, so I think we do appreciate the sort of thing that goes into these set piece speeches, but also we learn to look at not just what is said, but how it's said, and read between the lines. And I think maybe with the Bush speeches, maybe we try to read a little too much between the lines, because he is quite a transparent politician.
Transparent politician. Stephen Hess, interesting phrase to describe George Bush. Is he, in your opinion, also a transparent politician? Somebody who you don't have to read between the lines.
I think he's. What he is, it's all out there. I would tend to agree with that. But what was reminded me when Mary said the thing about the uranium, as I listened to parts of that speech last night, I also remembered the vetting process that I had to go through as a speechwriter under Eisenhower, where the economists and the lawyers were just down upon you on every single word. If I had put in there something like Carl Sandburg, the fog comes in on little cat's feet, they will say, show me the cat. And, you know, there were statements yesterday in that. He talked about, for instance, jobs at 4.6 million. In other words, over the past 2.5 years, well, the economists, our economists and Eisenhower said, why 2.5 years? What's that mean? Well, of course, you pick a good benchmark if you want. You say, well, how about over the 5 years that he's been president? So, and I think that reflected in the uranium thing, too. There is not the same sort of vetting, the same sort of serious intent. And why? Because, again, it's a semi-campaign speech.
Mary Duszewski, quickly back to you. One would assume that Tony Blair or another other heads of state in Europe probably are pretty careful when they make a speech of this kind. But there really is nothing, I suppose, comparable to a speech by the President of the United States. Is that part of what we're talking about here?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's interesting that my impression was that Bill Clinton was very aware of this from a very early stage. He understood that he was talking not just to the domestic audience, but to the world. And my impression of George Bush was that his first couple of State of the Union addresses were very much America-focused, and there was less awareness of the international audience. I think this last one and the one before were very much projected abroad, and this time we saw messages directed straight to the Iraqis, to the Allies, to Iran. All these messages were sent across in this State of the Union address.
Stephen Hess, does that also, though, have a domestic significance in as much as the president's strongest point at this point, at this moment, seems to be national security and protection of the American people, those kinds of issues, which obviously involve foreign policy?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. The president and Karl Rove and all the others can do lick their finger and put it up to the wind. They call it polling, and they know exactly what their strong points are and what they aren't. So given the hand that they were dealt this year, which was a pretty weak hand, clearly they were going to do the national security, play the national security card.
Thanks to you both, Stephen Hess of the Brookings Institution, Mary Jaszewski of the Independent Newspaper in London, and thanks to our earlier guests, Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center, David Korn of The Nation, Byron York of the National Review. This is To the Point from PRI. In France, Germany, Italy, and Spain, newspapers have reprinted caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad to support a Danish paper that's received death threats and provoked diplomatic sanctions. More on that in a moment on free speech and protecting the sacred on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Mormon Ali back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. Islamic tradition bans any depiction of the Prophet Muhammad. All over the Arab world and among millions of Muslims in Europe, there have been widespread angry protests over published caricatures of the Prophet, which first appeared in the Danish paper Jyllands Posten. Now, other papers in Europe have published them too. Bruce Clark is Europe correspondent for The Economist magazine, currently reporting to us from London. And Bruce, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
One of the responses, I understand, was in Francoir, which had a cartoon showing Buddhist, Jewish, Muslim, and Christian gods all floating on a cloud with the Christian deity saying, "Don't complain, Muhammad, we've all been caricatured here." What does this come from? Why this response to what happened in Denmark?
Well, I suppose that reflects a very French sensibility. You know, France has a particular tradition of secularism, a very strong belief that no faith should seek any kind of public privilege. I know that in America there's a secular tradition as well, but in France it's somehow even stronger, and it's held to be a matter of principle that the public arena should be completely free of any attempt by any faith to dominate it, and I think that's what's being reflected a bit.
Are you surprised that this has also been the case in Spain and Italy, which are Catholic countries?
I'm a little surprised. I'm a little nervous, in a way, about what's happening. And frankly, I was a bit surprised by the naivety of the Danish newspaper in not anticipating this reaction. I think it may only be the beginning of quite a long story in the encounter between a sort of post-Enlightenment, relatively secular Europe and an Islamic world that takes these symbols very seriously indeed.
Tell us a little bit more about the Danish paper, Jyllands Posten, which, as I understand it, has apologized.
That's right. The paper has said that it certainly didn't intend to cause so much offense. I think there have been a series of apologies from Denmark, including from the Prime Minister. All of them sound sort of a little sort of clumsy and late in the day somehow to Muslim ears. But I think that in Denmark and perhaps other European quarters, there's a bit of sort of surprise and bewilderment at the reaction this has caused.
It's been going on for a long time. The paper's the first publication was in September, was it not?
That's right, but the reaction really seems to be gathering steam just in recent days. Yes, in fact, it was this week that there was a formal apology from the editors, but at the same time, it was also this week that there was a demonstration by Palestinians in Gaza against Denmark and against the cartoons and so on. And there have been bomb scares in Denmark and reactions all over the Muslim world. The issue seems to be snowballing this week in particular.
Have there been fatwas issued, are you aware, against the paper or the people involved in it? That certainly happened from time to time, most famously, of course, with the great novelist.
I'm not aware of any specific fatwas against individuals, but certainly, we've heard some threats from militant movements in the Middle East to, for example, attack citizens, Scandinavian citizens who may be traveling in that part of the world. We've heard that Nordic aid workers are withdrawing from several Middle Eastern countries, including Yemen. There was a raid this week, apparently, on the European Union's office in Gaza, which seem to be connected with the cartoon affair. So there is quite a spreading reaction in several parts of the Middle East.
You said you were nervous because of all of this. I can understand why you would say that. But you also said it's going to be going on for a long time to come. I take it then that the press in Europe isn't going to back down.
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think that I find myself wondering, do the press sort of realize what they're taking on? I certainly don't think that the Danish paper that published the cartoons had any idea of the reaction that it was going to trigger. If it's the case that there is a massive drop in the sales of certain European products in the Middle East, if European economic interests are very, very badly hurt as a result of this affair, then, being a cynic, it makes me wonder, how long the European press, the European establishment, if you like, is going to go on holding on in a purist way to its Voltairean principles.
Talking with Bruce Clark, who's European Europe correspondent for The Economist magazine. Well, how important, then, is the principle of secular free speech in Europe? Is it something that you think can or ought to be compromised?
Well, we've been talking about that a lot in Britain just in the last few days, because last night, in fact, there was a debate in our parliament about a new religious hatred law, and with rather a surprising result, in that the government was defeated. The government wanted to pass, in a fairly robust form, a law outlawing the incitement of religious hatred, of whom the main supporters were the Muslim lobby in this country, and under pressure from a sort of an odd coalition, if you like, of secularists and evangelical Christians, the government was forced, in effect, to accept some amendments which significantly watered down that law and protected freedom of speech, including the freedom to engage in robust religious debate. So there's been quite a vigorous discussion about that very issue in Britain in the last few days.
I suppose one of the issues would be, what do you mean by incitement?
Indeed. Indeed, what do you mean by religious hatred as well? Hatred is a state of mind. How do you that state of mind is not in itself illegal as long as you don't act on it. By inciting somebody to a state of mind which is not itself illegal, you're now deemed to be committing an illegal act. It's quite a difficult sort of philosophical area, this. But on the other hand, our Muslim community feels very strongly that it should be protected in the same way as, for example, the Jews and Sikhs are protected from gratuitous attacks against them.
Tell us a little bit more about the Muslim community in London, which I understand is relatively diverse. Does it appear to be unified in this regard, or is it principally the more fundamentalist people who are the most concerned?
Not necessarily the most fundamentalist, but I would say the most politically active. I would say that the strongest Muslim lobby organization in Britain has been very, very actively campaigning for the passage of this law. And this is a broad-based lobby group which has incorporates sort of hundreds of smaller organizations within its ranks. So it can certainly make a claim to be a legitimate voice of the Muslim community, not the only one, of course. And it among the issues of concern to the community as a whole, I think the religious hatred issue would rank quite high.
When the government was making its case for the law, was there talk about the London bombings and the possibility that there might be more of that kind of thing?
Well, I think that actually not only since the London bombings, but really ever since September the 11th, in which many British people were killed, of course, the government has felt that there should be a twin strategy of, on one hand, cracking down on terror itself as hard as possible, but at the same time, promoting good interfaith relations and trying to avoid anything that could poison Christian-Muslim relations, poison the atmosphere, and therefore create the ground for terrorism to arise.
Now, you're the Europe correspondent for The Economist, so tell us a little bit more about the different countries in Europe. We talked about France, a very little bit about Spain and Italy. What about the Netherlands? And I know Germany, one of the German papers reproduced the cartoons as well, but in the Netherlands particularly, as well as in France, there's been a lot of unrest on the part of Muslim people.
That's right. I think that, yes, I mean, indeed, before this incident, I would have said that probably if there was one country where relations between Muslim immigrants and the host nation had really sort of become very sharp and antagonistic, the Netherlands was probably it. I know you'll be familiar with the story of the Dutch filmmaker, Theo van Gogh, who was murdered by a Muslim extremist, and his, one of his closest associates, who was herself of Muslim origin, of Somali origin, was then subjected to death threats and so on. And in that very antagonistic climate, I mean, there was a phase of really something like interreligious violence in the Netherlands when mosques were being burned down. There was sort of tit-for-tat attacks on targets which were perceived to epitomize either the Christian or the Muslim faith. And the Netherlands went through a phase of really extreme interreligious antagonism of a degree that hasn't been seen anywhere else in Europe, and it was rather frightening to observe.
The German paper that published the photograph said, Muslims understand satire? I suppose that goes right to the crux of the issue, doesn't it, and the differences that cultures have in looking at the same things.
Indeed, and I frankly find that a rather insensitive comment on the part of the German paper. I think that it's true of every culture, and it certainly goes for Germany as much as anywhere else, that in every culture there are things or institutions or symbols which are deemed to be sacrosanct, and about which satire is not appropriate. So frankly, I find that comment on the part of the German newspaper to be a rather crass one.
Bruce Clark, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Europe correspondent for The Economist magazine. Today's program produced by Sharon Rimbaum with Katie Cooper and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.